Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. I mean, yes, corporate news and tax policy, of course, but mostly me and RuPaul having a cup of coffee. Shantae from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 23rd of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We go two different ways as we begin the program today, the goods and the bads. The winners and the losers, the lucky and the maybe not so lucky. Because in a lot of ways, and I'm thinking here of corporate America specifically, there are two different things happening in this economy right now. First, in the rotation, U.S. manufacturers, which fall in the not-so-lucky category. Case in point, shares of Caterpillar, the heavy equipment company, tumbled today after noting that its materials and shipping costs are rising, the trade war being the proximate cause. Winners we will do in about 90 seconds, but first, manufacturers warning of harder times as they deal with higher costs due to the president's tariffs and the threat of retaliation by this country's trading partners. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Caterpillar, the Illinois-based manufacturer of industrial engines and earth movers, actually had a lot of good news in its earnings report. Profits up 46% from a year ago, sales up in every major region around the world. Still, Caterpillar's stock was punished, in part, says Elizabeth Vermillion at CFRA Research, because supply costs to feed its production lines are going up due to trade conflicts.
Tariffs are definitely driving the uncertainty, and then China's economic slowdown.
Vermillion says so far Caterpillar's adapted pretty well, but other industries haven't been so lucky. Ford is scheduled to release earnings tomorrow. A top executive said this week that Trump administration tariffs are hurting the automaker's profits. Christian Jicek is at the Center for Automotive Research.
We have the highest prices in the world right now for aluminum and steel. This is a very narrow margin business. You know, it doesn't seem like that when you go to buy a car, but on new vehicles, small sedans, you may only make a couple $100.
Lauren Wilk at the Aluminum Association says overall manufacturers are optimistic because of the strong economy.
But the tariffs, I think, are making folks hit the pause button. They need the certainty of the supply chain in order to go ahead with investments or expansion.
So far, manufacturers haven't hit the pause button on hiring. Last month, employment rose by nearly 20,000. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There are plenty of companies reporting strong profits and making rosy forecasts. Companies that have managed to stay out of the trade war or that have played the corporate tax cut just right. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has the winners.
There's something working in favor of pretty much all companies this year, the new tax law.
One of the biggest ways is that it lowers the tax rate.
Fabio Gertner teaches at the Wisconsin School of Business. A lower tax rate means companies keep more of their money. Thing is, something else has been going on this year that's been a negative for a lot of companies. The tariffs. So the corporate winners right now are the ones that are kind of immune from tariffs because they don't manufacture or export physical products. Bernie Baumol is an economist at the Economic Outlook Group.
Certainly the banking industry, telecom, entertainment, I mean, those are industries that obviously are not that exposed in the event of a trade war, but have benefited from the cut in taxes.
Healthcare is another example. And we're seeing this trend play out now that earnings season is underway. Last week, earnings jumped for banks like Bank of America and JP Morgan. We've also seen strong earnings reports from United Healthcare and Verizon. But just because these companies haven't been hurt by tariffs yet doesn't mean they won't be. Greg McBride at Bankrate.com says, look at the banks.
They could ultimately feel some effects from it if those companies that are directly impacted by tariffs, if they see a drop-off in business, if they start to scale back their investment or their borrowing.
And if that happens, there won't be as many winners left. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
One quick item to follow up on yesterday's broadcast before we go on. President Trump's claim that he is going to get a tax cut done before the midterms. House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady said today that he has got the president's back. kinda. Here is the relevant part of Brady's press release. He is going to introduce a new tax cut, quote, to be advanced as Republicans retain the House and the Senate. On Wall Street today, it was terrible. And then it was a little less terrible. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Not too often you get to sit down and have an early morning cup of coffee with a person who basically created an entire industry, but I went out to West Hollywood last week to do exactly that. RuPaul is known by a lot of you, perhaps, as the founder and the force behind RuPaul's Drag Race, a drag queen reality competition on VH1. But he has been a fixture in the entertainment business for a whole lot longer than that. In drag and in street clothes, as a musician, actor, and talk show host, he's an author and a television producer, too. Anyway, we met at a restaurant out in West Hollywood early, as I said. I got there first, so I poured.
What are you taking your coffee?
I'll have it black. Actually, black with cream. I'll have some cream.
Coffee served.
That is delicious.
Is it good?
We shot the breeze for a little while. We're both early risers, it turns out. And then we got to it.
I usually get up at 4. This morning, it was, I woke up at, I think, probably 1:40. I tried to go back to sleep, but I couldn't.
So are you an early-to-bed guy, or what?
Yeah, I was in bed by 9. So I got maybe 4 hours. Is that? I'm not good with math. Is that 4 hours?
Is that a chronic thing? Have you always done that?
Always have, yeah. Well, you know, when I was in the club world in New York, I would go to bed at 6 in the morning and probably wake up at noon, 1 o'clock.
This is probably an inelegant way to start this, but you're no spring chicken anymore, so how do you keep going at the pace you keep going?
I like colors and beauty and love and music and art. I like things that are pretty, and the beautiful things keep me going.
All through the long day?
All through the long day, yeah. And I love solving problems at work, creative problems, you know. So I think, how are we going to do this? I think, that's fun.
Do you ever look around, given, you know, where you started and the transformation that you have made in your life, do you ever look around and go, this is crazy that I'm here?
It is crazy. During the production meeting yesterday, I examined why it felt so weird that these 30 production heads were sitting around me doing this thing because of me, you know?
Yeah.
And I examined it and I thought, Rue, why do you feel... undeserving is the wrong word, but why does this feel so odd to you?
Still, even today, you've been doing this a long time.
Yeah, it has to do with an identity I created from childhood, where my father, you know, I wasn't a big priority for my father.
Yeah.
So, you know, kids create this. I created this identity, and it's been hard to shake, even though everything's proven all that wrong.
Yeah, and it's worked out pretty well, right?
Yeah.
When did you know that this was who you were?
Well,
or are, I guess.
No, it's not who I am. It's what I do for a living.
Really? No, come on.
Yes, it is.
First of all, I love that laugh. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's what I do for... It's my favorite thing, by the way, to do is to laugh on this planet. It's my favorite thing. I knew I was going to be famous. I started in theater and rock and roll bands and stumbled into drag. And it was like the universe said, do that. And I said, okay. I don't know how that's going to work, but okay. Did it. And I was escorted to the front of the line.
Yeah. Or maybe you pushed your way based on
what? A little bit of both. You know, you have to be. I am ambitious, definitely.
Yeah. There's a question here I want to ask about, and it revolves around who you are and what you do, but also you as an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are, right? You're an entrepreneur. What's your risk tolerance?
Risk tolerance? How about all or nothing? risk tolerance.
You know, because you made risky choices early in your life when you decided to be who you are.
Yeah.
But also, you know, pitching shows and Drag Race and DragCon and all of those entrepreneurial things you've done came with risk.
Yeah, sure. Everything is a risk. Listen, life is hard. And life is hard whether you choose to be a shot caller or to sit at home and watch daytime television all day. And the risks really have little to do with losing things or losing a lot of money. It has to do with losing your ability to get out of bed in the morning and to feel excited about living life. You never know where that next big idea is coming from, and you have to be really a seeker. And I've been a seeker from day one. I always wanted to know how this worked, what's behind all this, what's under the hood.
Can we talk for a second about this book?
Yeah.
Guru.
Yeah.
It's a collection of small essays, right?
Yeah.
And you're pretty open in here about some of the challenges and about the intentionality with which you have gone about drag. It's expensive, first of all. Holy cow, you must spend a lot of money on this.
It's not really about the money. I am the queen of queens, and the queen of queens deserves to look, is expected to look like $1 million, you know?
Even though it costs $1 million. I mean,
yeah,
I don't want to.
It costs a lot more than a million. It costs a lot, but, you know, I've been at this for a long time, you know.
Yeah. There's a page in here where you talk about how you wanted to create your iconic look.
Yes.
And a silhouette that was easily done by caricaturists.
Yes.
And photographers. You thought this through.
Yeah, listen, it's not rocket science. You know, I've always been looking for the secret recipe, you know, and I've always felt like the little boy who fell to earth. And I thought, you know what, I don't fit in to society, but I can figure this out. So I paid attention, I looked, and the combination I used to create this larger-than-life character that's my public persona, I used all the things that I love. David Bowie, Cher, James Brown, Diana Ross, Dolly Parton, threw them all in there and created this iconic look.
If I say that you created the modern drag industry with Drag Con and Drag Race, am I overstating the case, do you think?
Oh, hell no. No, No, I've earned the right to say I am definitely the queen of queens. I'm the most famous drag queen in the world. I'm the most famous drag queen ever in the history of humans on this planet. And that's...
If you say so yourself.
And that is the truth. You know, I've read articles where people say, regarded as one of the most famous. I'm like, really, B? Really? I mean, come on.
And yet... you don't do drag very much anymore.
I do it. If somebody's paying me, I'll do it. I'll do it. If somebody's ready to throw down some serious cash, I am available.
But here we are. You're in street clothes. You're in street clothes on the show a lot.
Yeah.
Is it just, it's not a, here's the question. Do you not need to do it anymore?
No, I've never needed to do it. It's what I do really
come on,
well.
Really?
It's what I learned how to do it really well. People responded to it. But I've said it many times, and I'll say it again. You're born naked, and the rest is drag. We are all in drag. And you put on a certain drag to navigate and work a certain system that you need to make happen. You're in drag right now.
Khakis and a sweater.
That's your drag, khakis and a sweater. Sometimes I wear khakis and a sweater, and there's a purpose behind it when I do it.
Which is what?
Usually when I'm wearing khakis and a sweater, it's like I don't want to be seen.
Yeah.
I don't want anybody to see me.
But that's got to be tough for you, right? I mean, here you are, a tall, bald, black guy, right?
Yeah.
With a certain bearing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Is it tough for me? No, it's not tough. I use clothes. I use my body to navigate this world.
I'm surprised that you came by yourself. You have no entourage.
I'm not that bitch. I work with a lot of people. I'm working with some people now. They come with 20 people.
Yeah.
I get things done. I want to get the job done, get in, out, and be on my way.
But, amen.
And I was never that, the entourage person.
Yeah.
Never.
I was going to ask what's next, but for you. But I imagine you're just going to see what happens.
Well, I like to get through this day first, and then I've got a lot of things on the calendar, but I like what I do. I love the fact that our show has launched the careers of 140 drag queens who are now making hundreds of thousands of dollars around the world.
Which gets me to this, and there's, I think there's some irony to this question, but I don't know why. In a lot of ways now, you're the man.
Yeah, sure, I'll take that. Yeah. Hey, you know what? Things change. There's a time when I couldn't get arrested in this town, and I haven't forgotten that either. But everything's cyclical. You know, everything changes. I'm having a great time right now. And that's really all that matters, honestly.
RuPaul, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was just a bit of my coffee with Ru. There is a bunch more from that interview, including his thoughts on Drag Race and what it's like to live a day as RuPaul on our Corner Office podcast. Coming up,
there are more smokers in China than we've got population here in the United States.
Where there's smoke, there may be tariffs. But first, let's do the numbers. Wild, wild ride on Wall Street today. Just after the open, the Dow Industrials cratered nearly 550 points before rebounding. Blue chips ended down 125.5%, 25,191. S&P 500 dropped 15.5%, finished at 27.40. The NASDAQ slipped 31 points, about 0.4%, finished things at 74.37. Caterpillar, as we were saying, helped drive the sell-off. Heavy equipment maker said tariffs are doing it. Shares tanked roughly 7.5%. 3M unspooled 4.3%. Unspooled, get it, 3M? After the consumer goods giant said a slowing Chinese economy could hurt sales, shares of Harley-Davidson sputtered 2.2%. Company said domestic sales of Hog motorcycles were down compared to last year. That's its ticker symbol, too, by the way, HOG. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is able to do what we do every day thanks to funding from public radio stations, foundations, corporate underwriters, and listeners like you. Thank you to all the Marketplace investors who've contributed over the past year for helping keep public service journalism strong. We appreciate your support.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a four-letter word that's becoming more and more important in this economy, and J-O-B-S ain't it. We here at Marketplace, we are going to go with debt. The government is piling on ever more of it, as we have been telling you. Also, though, companies, of which Netflix is the latest, the company says it's going to float $2 billion in new corporate bonds to fund new content, that is new movies and new series, which is on top of more than $8 billion in long-term debt company already carries. Marketplace's Justin Ho looks at why Netflix just keeps on borrowing.
Watch the fictional marriage of Queen Elizabeth II on the Netflix drama The Crown, and you'll feel like the set alone costs more than the Queen's actual wedding. James McQuivy at Forrester Research says Netflix is spending a lot to produce content.
We're not talking about, you know, Dragnet or the Brady Bunch. These shows are millions of dollars per episode, and that money has to come from somewhere.
To pay for all that, Netflix has been issuing billions in corporate debt. A Netflix executive says he wants the company to have 1,000 original shows by the end of this year. McQuivy says the streaming service has to outbid its competitors.
It's now bidding against Amazon, and it's bidding against Apple and Snap and all these companies that are saying, well, we want to do original content too.
To keep up its borrowing, Netflix needs to keep adding new customers, and it has been. Just last week, the company announced it added almost 7 million new subscribers in the third quarter. That means its income is rising. David Yermak at NYU's Stern School of Business says as long as that's the case, investors will be eager to lend to Netflix.
It's just like a person with a high income personally could afford a big car loan or a big mortgage. It's really the same logic for a company.
Investors are also attracted by the interest rates Netflix is paying on its debt. Moody's just gave its latest round of borrowing a junk rating. Mateo Arena at Marquette University says that's only a problem if Netflix can't keep up its profits.
If the debt load goes up without profitability going up at the same time, then yes, your credit rate is going to go down, right?
But he doesn't think that's going to happen, as long as Netflix keeps making content that attracts new subscribers. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Netflix shares were up today during a down session. Toymaker Hasbro, though, was among the losers after missing analysts' expectations yesterday. The company said the strong dollar hurt them, also a certain bankruptcy. Marketplace's Emma Jacobs looks at the Toys R Us effect on the coming all-too-soon holiday season.
For toy consumers, the news is good. Toys R Us closed early enough in the year for many retailers to be able to get more products on their shelves for the holidays.
Anna Serafin-Smith of the National Retail Federation says that means you'll be able to find more toys on the shelves of JCPenney, Kohl's, and even Party City.
There has been an increase in ordering a lot more toys from a variety of different companies to be able to deliver those items on time.
For toy manufacturers, the news since the retailer's closing hasn't been so good.
Maybe it was a little bit worse than they had thought.
Susan Anderson follows Hasbro for the investment bank B. Riley FBR. She says the toy maker is responding to the new retail landscape by opening a new distribution center in the Midwest.
The distribution channels are just a lot different. You know, you have a lot more retailers carrying toys in smaller lots versus Toys R Us.
That means consumers might want to start their toy shopping early this year.
I say this every year, but especially this year.
Chris Byrne is a toy historian and independent analyst.
There's a little bit more uncertainty about where things will be and where there will be in stock and will there be enough inventory.
The big losers this holiday season could be small toy manufacturers. They'll miss the marketing boost they used to get by having their products alongside blockbusters on Toys R Us shelves. I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
Farming is a tough way to make a living, no matter the crop. There's always the weather to deal with, never mind hurricanes in the southeast this time of year. Florence and Michael did a whole lot of damage the past couple of months. Now, though, consider the crop, but also trade policy, and you'll discover that tobacco farmers in North Carolina are in a jam. Fewer people in the United States are smoking, of course, so most of the tobacco crop is marketed overseas, especially China. But because this is the way trade wars work, China has put American tobacco products on its tariff lists. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that story.
Triple B Farms covers about 800 acres in Johnston County, North Carolina, about 45 miles southeast of Raleigh. Brandon Batten is one of the owners. He's 32 and runs the farm with his dad and his uncle. They farm corn, wheat, and soybeans, but he says their cash crop is tobacco. And right now, he's stuck without a whole lot of farming to do.
Normally, around the middle to the end of October, we would be wrapping up harvest, but unfortunately, that was a bit early this year. The tobacco that we had in the field was destroyed when Florence came through.
Batten says Johnston County got about 18 inches of rain in 3 days, and the roots were washed out. Tobacco leaves are harvested annually, 3 or 4 times a year, and the last harvest in October renders the highest quality tobacco. For Batten, that harvest pays the bills. Florence guaranteed he'll be out that money, but he says sales were already down because of President Trump's trade war with China. Last year, North Carolina exported more than $150 million in leaf tobacco to China, making China the largest consumer of the state's tobacco in the world. In April, the Chinese raised the tariff on American tobacco from 10% to 35%.
90% of what we grow is for export. And not only this year are we facing possibly reduced sales and reduced market prices because of the Chinese tariffs. We're also looking at potential contract cuts for next year.
Because if this year's crop can't be sold, it'll remain on the shelf until it's gone. And Batten says he'll be unlikely to find a contract with cigarette companies for next year's crop if that's the case. Larry Wooten is the president of the North Carolina Farm Bureau.
China's our largest export, was our largest export customer for tobacco. There are more smokers in China than we've got population here in the United States.
China makes up a third of all cigarette consumption in the world these days. And as domestic smoking continues to dwindle, tobacco farmers in North Carolina have to look to international markets to fill the gap. Wooten says he doesn't think the Trump administration knows what these tariffs are doing to tobacco farmers.
Tobacco was an easy target. Doesn't have many friends in Washington, but for our farmers here in North Carolina, it was devastating.
Brandon Batten is the sixth generation in his family to farm. Says it's in his blood. But he's got a young son and twins on the way, so he's struggling to decide whether farming is still a viable way of life.
I did want to farm because I love it. I have a passion for it, but at the end of the day, I can't do it for free because I have to support my family too, and it's definitely a struggle and something that's always on my mind.
He says if he does keep farming, he'll consider changing what he plants to better reflect market shifts.
Tobacco is our cash crop, but, you know, we have talked about other things. Hemp is obviously on the horizon. You know, with the new farm bill, it could become technically, you know, legalized so that you could grow it. I think that's an exciting new potential market.
But changing what you farm isn't something folks in North Carolina can do immediately. Tom Boyke says some politicians understand that. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former U.S. trade negotiator.
What's hard about this current trading environment, of course, is that China is a big market for North Carolina farmers, and this change has come suddenly for them.
And the effects of the trade war likely won't disappear as abruptly as they've emerged, says Colin Carter. He's a professor of agriculture and resource economics at the University of California, Davis.
If the U.S. annoys China and China responds, they will not come back overnight.
Because, he says, China can go elsewhere for its tobacco, like Brazil, Zimbabwe, or Argentina. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, today's entry in the Gosh, Washington sure is an interesting place, isn't it? File. There's a new report out from the White House Council of Economic Advisors that is, to quote the White House website, the agency charged with offering the president objective economic advice on the formulation of both domestic and international economic policy, to wit, today's official CEA report titled The Opportunity Costs of Socialism. The first paragraph of the executive summary of which reads, coincident with the 200th anniversary of Karl Marx's birth, socialism is making a comeback in American political discourse. Like I said, gosh, Washington's an interesting place. All right, we got to go. Wall Street today, not as bad as it could have been. Let's just say that. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Mutti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.